So, in terms of the modern sort of field of evolutionary psychology, really goes back to the early 1990s. And as such, evolutionary psych is very much a field in progress. There's a lot of things happening very recently. Some of this has to do with things happening in genetics and behavioral genetics as well. But part of it is also just starting from relatively few people involved to kind of catching on and having lots of research over the last, certainly about 12 to 15 years, a large amount of research occurring in the area and getting a lot of new ideas coming out of this. As such, in any sort of new-ish field, you will have a certain amount of disagreement and debate about the underlying theory. This occurs with, early classical conditioning, operant conditioning. If you go back to physics, look at the beginnings of atomic physics through late 19th or 20th century, we see again these sorts of debates. So this is very common in any new field of science, is to have some competition and serious debate about underlying theory elements. So Lita Cosmide and John Tooby at UC Santa Barbara really are sort of seen as the modern founders, or the founders of modern evolutionary psychology. That is, taking people that were dabbling in evolutionary theory and applying it to the various fields and saying, look, we're going to unify this. We're going to say this is a consistent theoretical approach that we can take to integrating Darwinian biological evolutionary theory into the social sciences, psychology, sociology, etc. So through the late 1980s to very early 1990s, they'd been working in their own area, their husband-wife team. She's in cognitive psychology, he's in anthropology. They're bringing evolutionary concepts into their work. 1992, they edit a book called The Adapted Mind. And this is really sort of where the formalization of the underpinnings of modern evolutionary psychology come from. They then set up the Center of Evolutionary Psychology at Santa Barbara and start training students. We're sort of really only, maybe I'll come back to that. Well, no, one of the things with this is through the 1990s, anybody that came into evolutionary psychology, and even actually into the beginning of the 21st century, really anybody that was really working in evolutionary psychology had come there from somewhere else. So they hadn't been trained as an evolutionary psychologist. They were anthropologists or psychologists or computing scientists or biologists or something. They hadn't specifically been trained in evolutionary psychology. They were linguists or philosophers. Cosmides and Tooby, with their Center for Evolutionary Psychology, really trained the first graduate students in evolutionary psychology. This comes interesting. So then their graduate students went off and started doing work in evolutionary psychology and took their particular ideas with them. So we get an interesting little founder effect in terms of how the Santa Barbara schools approached evolutionary psychology, spread, and has perhaps become the most predominant, although there's debates about some of these things, as we'll see. Anyways, here's sort of in a nutshell the kinds of things that Cosmide and Tooby argued are these theoretical underpinnings with respect to evolutionary psych. And this is now sort of described as the evolutionary psychology Santa Barbara style. Okay? So first, universal human trait adaptations. It says that we should expect then to find a lot of similarities in certain behaviors across cultures and across time. Second, part of the reason that they suggest we should see this is because so much of the selective pressure that would have occurred on humans occurred back in the EEA. So back in the time period that ended roughly 8 to 10,000 years ago, when the environment was not changing terribly rapidly due to human involvement, when most humans existed as some sort of hunter-gatherer. Consequently, we would expect to have a lot of commonalities. Even if you're, you know, a North American hunter-gatherer versus a Eurasian hunter-gatherer, you're a hunter-gatherer. I mean, your lifestyle is pretty similar. So consequently, they argue that we would expect to see very similar selective pressures on all of the humans pre-roughly 10,000 years ago. Consequently, we would expect to find a lot of universal traits. And this is, in fact, what evolutionary psychologists should be primarily concerned with studying, are these commonalities. They also argue that evolution is slow. Consequently, even though we're sort of talking about the EEA is maybe ending 8 to 10,000 years ago, we shouldn't expect that this will have changed things very much. We should still expect to see lots and lots and lots of behaviors in modern humans that would have been under selective pressure back in the EEA, back in the Pleistocene. Sometimes you hear about the idea, you know, modern humans, modern bodies in a Pleistocene, you know, with the Pleistocene mind sort of thing. I don't think it's a particularly good comment, but so the idea that they had was that evolution is very slow. It worked. I mean, we've got these long generations. Consequently, you know, we shouldn't expect that a lot would have changed. Third, cognitive modules. They take Fodor's ideas of perceptual system modularity and they bootstrap it up to cognition. So Fodor is really talking about how you need these little modules, small neural networks that are doing dedicated, impenetrable tasks because perceptually it allows you to respond to things very, very, very quickly. Cosmites and Tubi say we think the same thing is happening with cognitive systems, that you've got much larger, more complex neural systems that are impenetrable, that are dedicated to particular cognitive problem solutions, and these solutions would have been the sort of things that our ancestors would have had to deal with going back 10,000 plus years ago. So we should expect to see these cognitive modules. Now, these sort of theoretical underpinnings are probably the most predominant approach to evolutionary psychology currently being practiced around the world. It's certainly the most popularized. Not everybody agrees with all of these elements. Some people quibble on the degree. Some people think there's glaring problems. But this is probably the most well-known sort of approach to it. Here's some things. Why did they focus in? Why did they decide to focus in on universal traits? Well, in some ways, they kind of copped out a little bit. But, I mean, they'd seen the I was about to call it a firestorm, but let's just call it the shitstorm of anger and aggressiveness that was directed towards E.O. Wilson back in the 70s with respect to concerns of social Darwinism. And frankly, they wanted to sidestep it and avoid it entirely. As a matter of fact, there was you know, early on through the 90s, there was a lot of debate. You know, so you got this new field called evolutionary psychology. Aren't you really just doing human sociobiology? And it's just, well, maybe. No, but, well, no. Because they didn't want to be associated with sociobiology. Right? And psychology, you know, the power that names have. Sociobiology becomes associated with eugenics, rightly or wrongly, and social Darwinism, rightly or wrongly. You want to start calling yourself a human sociobiologist? So you pick a new name, evolutionary psychology. So you make that break. My feeling, I mean, coming to this, I mean, my background's biology, so I started out as a zoologist. My psychology degree is very sort of biologically driven. I used to describe myself more as an ethologist, or I prefer the term natural historian to anything else, but regardless, I mean, my take on this is that, yeah, evolutionary psychology really just is sociobiology rebranded a bit. So, partially to avoid kind of the controversy, but that's okay. I mean, you know, there's a valid argument here. If you've got so many people attacking you because of your name, you're probably not going to be able to do really good research. You're spending most of your time trying to put out fires as opposed to doing the actual work. So, okay. Looking at the universal traits thing, this is a bit more politically correct. Okay? They're not saying, well, this particular race has this attribute, or this particular language group does it this way. She says, let's look at stuff that's universal to humans. So we're not picking out characteristics from individual groups. And we're not saying that this thing in one particular group is adaptive or maladaptive or better than or worse than. Let's look for the universals, okay? You can take and apply evolutionary theory to group-specific characteristics, but you run the risk of getting into all of these issues. So you avoid claims of racism by doing this. We're not focusing on any one group. We're looking at pan-human characteristics. Okay. Another issue here sort of comes out of Cosmide's background in cognitive psychology. Let alone in the 1990s, but I mean even today, the sort of specific link between cognition and genes is not particularly well understood. Getting better, with behavioral genetics, but it's still not really well understood. Some aspects of physiology with a few gene interactions are better understood, but because of this, again, trying to focus in on sort of population unique or specific cognitive structures is very, very difficult. If you've got very large sample size, if you're doing the whole human population, again, this tends to avoid some of the pitfalls. So, consequently, there you should be looking for these pan-human characteristics. What about the second idea here, that evolution is slow. Therefore, we should expect to see modern characteristics were due to adaptive selection or neutrality or whatnot in the past. If you go into the sort of history of biology, if you look back at the older biology, evolution, genetics, all these fields really did operate on the assumption that evolutionary change was going to be very slow. So in the late 1980s, early 1990s, when Cosmides and Tooby sort of formalized this, to be fair, they were in fact using the kind of best science of the day. The science of the day said evolution for humans is really freaking slow. We've got these stunningly long generations. That's going to make it slow. And frankly, you're just not going to get that much genetic change really that rapidly. Okay? So given that, this really was the best science of the late 1980s, early 1990s, makes their statement that, you know, you've got a Pleistocene mind in this modern body, a pretty reasonable assumption, right? That these adaptive selections, these traits that we have today would have been selected for well in the past, and we shouldn't expect that much new has happened in the last 8 to 10,000 years. That was pretty reasonable. That being said, modern biology, evolutionary theory, and genetics work is showing there's some problems with this. Evolutionary change, even in things like humans, may not be as slow as we thought it was in the past. So this is being challenged. So, for example, Hawks and colleagues, 2007, did, don't worry about the details of this, but particular type of behavioral genetics study, so-called a linkage disequilibrium study of a HapMap genome data set. Don't worry about that. They've got access to a lot of genetic details, and they study them. Okay, so and they're using this with samples of data sets from lots and lots and lots of people from around the world. What they found when they looked at this, when they analyzed the results, was that evidence supports that there's actually been quite a bit of recent selection. In fact, there's been strong selective forces on at least, from their study, at least 1,800 genes within the last 10,000 years. Is that a lot? It's like, well, we've only got about 30,000 genes. So, you know, 1,800 is a pretty big chunk of them, actually, you know, when you look at this. They used a particular technique where they looked for how pressures or how selection might have been operating on particular allelic variants of genes. And so what they're finding is about 7% of the human genome has been under relatively strong selective pressures within the last 10,000 years. That is, well after the Santa Barbara sort of cutoff for the era of evolutionary or the environment of evolutionary adaptation has ended. If you take this back further, not just the last 10,000 years, but the last 50,000 years, what the results are showing is that, in fact, actually, evolutionary forces on humans have been increasing over the last 50,000 years. In other words, we're evolving more rapidly than our predecessor species, Homo erectus, Homo habilis, Australopithecines. Evolution is speeding up. Now, why? Well, population increase would be a biggie. Bigger population is just the greater variation you have within the population, the greater chance for outbreeding, the more variation that's going to put in. Again, with population size leads to cultural complexity. So there's cultural developments that can even bootstrap this up more rapidly. And ecological modification. Certainly within the last 10,000 years, we've been mucking around with the environment in a big way, building dikes, slashing and burning down forests for agriculture, hunting practices, all kinds of things. The technology allows us to change things dramatically. So it's not really a surprise when you look at it this way. Wang and colleagues from 2006 took a look at a similar sort of process here. What they did was identify biologically, what they call biologically functional categories for gene function. And they were looking specifically here for genes that have perhaps gone through a shift or through selective pressures within the last 40,000 years, generally more recently here. What they're finding is that there's a lot of very non-random selective pressures. In other words, there's something that's very specific to recent environmental influences on human selection. So it's not just stuff that's happening randomly. I mean, genetics can change just through random events. All right, that definitely is a big contribution to genetic factors, is just random events. Okay, what they're finding, Wang and colleagues are finding, is non-random selective pressures here. In particular, they identify things like pathogen-host interactions, issues about reproduction, DNA metabolism, cellular cycles, protein metabolism, and neuronal function. Now, all of these are stunningly important in humans. Let's just look at the neural function here. Okay, so just within this one category here, they find that there's genes that have been selected for, that have changed within the last 40,000 years, involving serotonin transporter, glutamate and glycine receptors, olfaction. We'll talk about olfactory issues with respect to what are called major histocompatibility complexes later. It's involved in your immune system. It's involved in perhaps mate choice. Synaptic associated proteins, and then a whole suite of other genes that are involved in doing various things in terms of neurons and brain expression. We don't know exactly what they do, but we know they're doing active things with respect to the way that our brains work. In terms of the neuronal function here, right, this is pretty big for us. If we take a look even at how we've managed to come up with new ways to develop technology, tools, interact over the last even 10,000 years, you know, we're moving an exponential curve. This is not a nice, low, slow, linear progression here. As we change the environment, we change the selective pressures. We bootstrap the selective pressures up. Those that have these attributes for neuronal functioning, there's where the selection is coming in at now, perhaps. So we're focusing this. In other words, without actually intentionally doing eugenics, without actually intentionally artificially selecting characteristics, by altering our environment in the way that we have as humans, we're forcing. I mean, we don't tend to get picked off by predators too often anymore. But your ability to manage your finances might be kind of important. Or your ability to handle reading or something else. So we're changing the selective pressures on us. Consequently, the Santa Barbara School's idea that this sort of, you know, things have really only sort of changed for us environmentally within the last 10,000 years, and therefore that's not a long enough time period for there really be genetic changes in terms of our behavioral systems, we really have to sort of reevaluate that. We could perhaps have seen some very significant behavioral changes, evolutionarily influenced changes on humans within this last 10,000 year period. We certainly were seeing it before this, you know, going 40, 50,000 years back. So it may not have been as constant as the Santa Barbara School has argued for in the past. Now again, to be fair to Cosmides and Tupi, they were using the best knowledge they had at the time. It's just that we probably need to revisit this. Cognitive modules, they're sort of last point here, that we have specific brain units that have evolved for specific ancestral tasks. They also argue that these cognitive modules will not have changed particularly much over, whatever, the last 100,000 years. Each module is going to exist for a single purpose. This makes a certain amount of sense from an evolutionary perspective. That could be a very good engineering way of producing a system. Unfortunately, evolution doesn't always engineer the best system. Evolution is a little bit, it works with what it's got. If you take any cognitive science courses, in fact, cognitive science tends to argue that the brain is a general pattern classifier. That your brain can solve just about anything that's thrown at it, that it's not limited to these modular systems. We'll talk more about this later on in the course. And this is probably one of the areas in evolutionary psychology that over the next 10 years or so may see the most kind of work in terms of theory development. Now, the last sort of thing here I just want to mention here, you know, so I go, okay, so why is the Santa Barbara School of Psychology so perhaps popular? Well, Cosmides and Tupi were the early adopters, right? That's one thing. They went out, they were the first ones to start really training graduate students in this. Their graduate students that came through their program were the first ones to say, hey, I'm actually an evolutionary psychologist. I've got a PhD in evolutionary psychology. That's my background. And so they take that out when they go on into academia, and they train their students, and you know, based on what they learn from their supervisors, it goes from there. You know, it's a catchy name, evolutionary psychology. I'll show you a couple of other names in a minute that aren't nearly as catchy here. And when you don't have a lot of competition, you can get out some popular books pretty quickly. So there's a lot of popular press books for the lay public that got out there that really promoted these ideas. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm all in favor of the lay public learning good science. But it certainly kind of overshadowed some of these other areas that have brought evolution into the social sciences. Now, just last, you know, whatever, 15, 20 minutes, I've been talking about these sort of perhaps issues with respect to the evolutionary psychology's theory. Don't take away from this that I'm teaching you a course in evolutionary psychology, but I think the stuff that's being taught in evolutionary psychology is all crap. Any field of science, people that work in the area will quibble about aspects of it. Doesn't say that people have been quibbling about aspects of, say, the memory system and cognitive psychology for the last 50 years. No one has said, that's it, we should just get rid of cognitive psychology, because clearly we can't agree. I mean, some of you may think after having, I don't know how your cognitive psychology course was, but, you know, some people may go, that'd be a great idea, because other people go, no, it's terrific, okay. In any field, scientists will debate the assumptions, the findings, the interpretations, the conclusions that are drawn about this. We see this in other areas of evolution. I mean, Darwin's original theory on evolution is not seen as being completely correct. His basic ideas are thought to be pretty solid, but there's been a lot of changes over the years. Go back into the 1920s, 1930s. It was called the modern synthesis. That was the integration. It took into the 1920s before people really started to integrate Mendelian genetics into Darwinian evolutionary theory, even though Mendel's work had been rediscovered by 1904. which took another 15 years for them to really start working the two together. And then that led to a whole kind of reinterpretation of both fields. So this is common. Evolutionary psych as a sort of field is really quite recent. There's you really have to expect people to debate. Matter of fact, a field that doesn't have that kind of debate is a pretty stagnant field. So, I mentioned that evolutionary psychology had a catchy name. What do you think? Human behavioral ecology or evolutionary psych? Which is catchier? Here's another one. Dual inheritance theory. DIT. At least you can pronounce DIT. You can say EP quickly, but HBE sounds like a bank or something. I don't know what kind of bank, but, you know, the Human Bank of Ecology, Ecuador, expense accounts. I don't know. Okay. Look, human behavioral ecology is actually around before Cosmides and Tooby say, hey, we're doing evolutionary psychology. It's a branch of behavioral ecology. Behavioral ecology is a subset of the biological sciences. Behavioral ecologists tend to look at biological systems, behavior systems, in terms of energy in, energy out. So there's a cost and a benefit for anything that organisms do, and how do they balance these energy structures. So human behavioral ecologists take and apply these principles of evolutionary theory and optimization. So when you're looking at cost benefits, it's like, so from a really sort of cost benefit, how does an organism going to optimize? It's got a limited number of resources, a limited amount of time in the day. It's got to maximize its energy that's coming in for all kinds of other purposes. How can it organize its behavior to optimize these? How can it get the most for the least? Okay, so it takes these ideas and tries to look at human behaviors and cultural diversity in this framework. It really takes its roots back to ethology, so biologists that would study behaviors, and the sociobiology coming out of the 1970s. A lot of this is done from a very ecologically driven context. So human behavioral ecologists, for example, unlike evolutionary psychologists, say, you know, we should be looking for human universals. Human behavioral ecologists say, well, depending upon the local environment, we should expect that different cultures will actually perhaps do things rather differently. We'll talk about what's called the waist-to-hip ratio later on in the course. Waist-to-hip ratio. Women, I will now demonstrate my lack of artistic abilities. Yes, it's Mrs. Peanut from Planters Peanuts. But, right, I mean, you get the idea. Your waist-to-hip ratio, so there's your waist, there's your hips, so you got a waist-to-hip ratio. Some work by Devinder Singh in the early 1990s found that, at least in Western countries, a waist-to-hip ratio of about 0.17 was absurd. 0.7, waist-to-hip ratio of 0.7 was seen as perhaps highly attractive by many males in Western cultures. But you take a look at groups that are hunter-gatherers, and it's more like 0.8 or 0.9. And you take a look here and you find out, well, the average, say, waist-to-hip ratio for American university students is around maybe 0.71. You take a look at, say, the average waist-to-hip ratio, so that's for females, 0.71. Males, about 0.89, let's say, waist-to-hip ratio of males, average undergraduate students. You take a look at hunter-gatherers, and you get the average female waist-to-hip ratio is about 0.83, 84, 85, and males maybe 0.97, things like this. Different cultures, different environments. Now, so you can't say universally 0.7 waist-to-hip ratio is the most beautiful. For hunter-gatherer groups, what you can say, though, at least, is that you can utilize a waist-to-hip ratio to distinguish between males and females. And something that is closer to the local idea of human-female averageness may be seen as more attractive. Similarly, women use They don't use waist-to-hip ratio so much for judging the attractiveness of males. They use shoulder to waist ratios. So this sort of pyramidal, upside-down triangle structure. Okay. So again, we can't say that it's a universal, that everyone all over the world thinks a 0.7 waist-to-hip ratio is oh so hot. And human behavioral ecologists say, well, duh, of course not. The environments are stunningly different. Depending on what you have to eat, depending on how your food is going to be available through the year, depending on why would you possibly have expected that it's going to be the same everywhere? But even human behavioral ecologists say, well, yeah, but sure, all humans all over the world are going to show some sort of preference for some specific body type, a locally specific body type, not a universally specific body type, but yeah, all over the world, definitely humans select mates based on physical features. So yeah, sure, that's universal. And sure, the waist-to-hip ratio may be involved in that, but your local environment is going to determine what that optimized pattern is. We'll talk about that more later. Here's the other one mentioned, dual inheritance theory. This really sort of comes out of anthropology more. It argues that culture and genes provide both separate but linked systems with respect to inheritance and variation. So it's kind of suggesting that culture goes through evolution as well, and that your natural selection will influence cultures, will influence the people in a culture's decision-making. That might be due to genetic factors. It might be due to evolved cultural systems, which brings in learning. And that somehow, however the culture transmits the information, is going to influence the behavior of the culture. One of the things with... does that sound kind of amorphous? It is a bit. It's a very complex theory. It tends to utilize... dual inheritance theorists tend to make use of very complex mathematical models. They often actually, in terms of their math, get along better with sort of the hard biologists. What do you mean by hard biologists? I mean, if you're a physicist, you think any biology is soft, but like the ecologists that will do ecological modeling and these sorts of things, who don't actually go out and look at the deer, they just get data and look at a computer screen with mathematical simulations. They actually fit there, but their sort of view on their take on culture, you know, these kind of biologists that are good at the numbers don't always quite get the cultural parameters from it. So, you know, they don't. It's a hard theory to kind of learn. It's not generally well accessible to your average, say, undergrad or even graduate student. So dual inheritance theory is actually very interesting, but it doesn't get a lot of play really outside of certain primarily areas of anthropology, cultural anthropology, and not even all areas of anthropology pay much attention to dual inheritance theory, but it's quite interesting. So my point is here, there's a variety of different fields, and there's others as well, but there's a variety of different fields that really take evolutionary parameters and look at the human condition with them. Winterhalder and Smith, back in 2000, sort of did a little comparison here. Said, well, you know, if we take a look at this, you know, here's our different groups. So explanatory focus, what are they looking at? Well, human behavioral ecologists look at the behavioral strategies, evolutionary psychology, look at these psychological mechanisms. Dual inheritance theorists are looking for the cultural evolution. How is this influencing an entire culture? What are the constraints? Well, ecology material for a behavioral ecologist, EP, cognitive, genetic. And the dual inheritance can see this as information. They sort of view cultures as their information. And however that information is encoded, be it genetic, be it linguistically, be it stories, be it through technology. So it's the structural informational systems that are really at our point. Different term time frames here. Short-term human behavioral ecologists see that if the environment changes rapidly, the organisms in that environment will change rapidly. They will adapt somehow. They will change. They're flexible. If they aren't flexible enough, they go extinct. But we can expect very rapid. EP, traditionally, has taken this very long-term view based just on genetics. Dual inheritance is somewhere in between. So yeah, you can go through the rest of this, but I mean, we see there's similarities, there's differences between these. They're all sort of doing ultimately the same sort of thing, but they're doing it in very different ways. And traditionally, they've been viewed as these very competitive, competing fields. See, they have these different assumptions, these different analytical models. They're allied in different ways with different disciplines. There's academic politics that come into play here. I mean, the human behavioral ecology is, you know, definitely over the sciences side of things. It's biology. You know, psychology, well, hey, look at us, you know, part in the arts, part in the science, you know. We're kind of a weird duck here. You know, you got your dual inheritance that traditionally comes out of anthropology, so usually more over on the arts side, like, say, with sociobiology, or probably sociology more. So you get things happening there, and grants and all kinds. But over the last, perhaps, decade, there's been an increasing sort of realization that maybe we're not as competitive as is traditionally been viewed. Maybe we can actually have some very complementary integration of this. So yes, there are different styles and different approaches. But look, even in psychology, as we've been saying, the different levels of analysis here, you know, your behavioral psychologist very much an approximate, your developmental, your proximate and ontogenetic. Psychology seems to integrate things fairly well. We approach it in different ways, but by looking across fields, we can get some very interesting insights. Perhaps we should be doing the same thing here. Perhaps we need to bring people from these different backgrounds together and see what this actually buys us. Now, there may be, obviously, limits to this sort of ability to complement things here. The same behavior cannot simultaneously be the product of each field's underlying assumptions. But that doesn't mean that different behaviors can't be. So the human behavioral ecologist might be right on this one, the evolutionary psychologist on that one, the dual inheritance theorist is right on another one. You bring them together to the gestalt and you might get a better picture of what's going on. So far, that has not happened. So far, these groups still don't talk to each other very much. It's difficult to pull people together from different, you know, different terminology. Remember, you got to spend a lot of time, okay, translating. When you say this, and I say this, what do we actually mean? Right? So we've got to have a translation program going there, too. Okay. So there's sort of a huge amount of background on things. Let's finally get into chapter two. So we've already talked about some of this. So he said, you know, Darwin talks about artificial selection there, but really only as a sort of teaching thing to get into his real ideas here in terms of natural selection. Very clear on this. Natural selection has no ultimate goal. It's the current environment that puts the selective pressures on the individuals that exist within that environment. Traits that increase the likelihood of survival will be selected for. Sexual selection. Now, some people say Darwin actually never said anything about sexual selection in The Origins of Species. He does, but he doesn't say very much about it. It really gets put off for a second book about a decade later. Sexual selection deals with any traits that increase the likelihood of mating. Okay, so the very interesting thing with sexual selection is traits that are selected for in terms of sexual selection may actually decrease the individual's chances of surviving for a longer period of time. So, you know, consider certain behaviors that, you know, dangerous activities that males may do to show off may make them, you know, may get them noticed by the females, but may also get them noticed by a predator, or they may eventually just try to show off in such a way that they end up, and head became separated from shoulders when trying to do that, you know, jumping the motorcycle over 27 school buses. So these can be issues there. Again, as I said, differential reproductive success, just to give you a slide that formalizes this here. It's not just how many offspring you have. It's the number of offspring you have that actually survive to be able to reproduce themselves. You have a lot of offspring, but they all die before reproducing. You suck. And thank you for playing the game of evolution. You lose. Crap. Unless, of course, your siblings have produced lots of offspring. Then you sort of win, but at a lesser level. Okay? So differential reproductive success. And this is one that's very commonly just mistaken. Even like, you know, high school textbooks will just say, you know, the more offspring you produce, the better you are. Evolution selects for you know, producing lots of babies. It's like, no, that's not quite true. Quick reminder on Mendelian genetics. Phenotype and genotype. Genotype is your actual underlying genome. It's what you got. Phenotype is the actual physical manifestation or behavioral manifestation. Phenotype is your genes interacting with the environment. You may have the genes to be 6'3", but if you were malnourished as a child, you may only reach 5'5". Okay? I had a friend during undergrad, Carol. She was about yay tall. Her family, refugees, immigrated over to Canada when she was about six. Her six, seven, big deal. Really doesn't matter, does it? Yeah. No. When she was young, her sister, who was born in Canada, looks stunningly like her. I mean, facial features very similar, but yay high. Okay. Sample size of like two. So, you know, anecdotal evidence. But, I mean, you see this all over, right? I mean, she was malnourished as a child. I've never gone in and looked at her genome, nor, you know, would I actually figure out what genes are actually involved in height. We don't know. But, I mean, we see this so often. Children that are malnourished, yeah, they tend to be shorter. You start giving people better nutrition, they reach the phenotype, genotype, okay? We often talk about things like, so, you've got the gene for brown eyes. No. You've actually got alleles. You've got an allele for brown eye color. Right? But we tend to get sloppy about this. Right? You've got the gene for pattern baldness. No, you've got an allelic form of the gene for pattern baldness. It looks like this. Right? Yeah, okay. But we get sloppy. Right? It takes on, say, you've got the allelic form of the gene for eye color, your allelic form is this. You have the brown eye gene. We just kind of sloppily do that, right? Each gene exists on a locus. The locus is the location on the chromosomes, just terms there. Homozygous, heterozygous. Homozygous means you've got two alleles that are the same for a gene. Heterozygous means they are different. You got one allele that would do something in terms of protein production, another one does something else. Dominant and recessive. Alleles can be dominant under basic Mendelian genetics, they can either be dominant or recessive. If it is dominant, if you have one copy of the allele, that is what will phenotypically manifest, all other things being equal. If you have recessive, if you only have one copy of a recessive, it will be, let's say, masked. It will not phenotypically manifest. If you have two copies of a recessive, then the recessive characteristic will show up in your phenotype. Again, all other things being equal. Mendel also said that inheritance is particulate, it is not blended. In other words, if you've got one dominant and one recessive, it's not sort of the middle point between them. Turns out you can get that. In non-additive genetics, but Mendel didn't know anything about that one, okay? But so this is your sort of basic Mendel. And the basic Mendelian does a great job of explaining a lot of stuff in genetics, okay? There's a few little quipsies and quibblies and whatnot, but if you're a geneticist, then you tend to worry about those, okay? Just know that they're there, but we don't have to worry about too much. Finally, as Mendel pointed out, Lamarck seems to have been wrong. You are born with the genes that you pass on. Whatever happens to you during your life doesn't actually change your genes, more or less. Leaving aside things like getting in and doing transgenic organisms or stuff like that, but that's pretty recent. Okay, so real quick rundown here, just to put it in a Mendelian example. So imagine these green things are peas. So we've got some plant that produces large peas, and we've got some plants that produce small peas. The way we, as you probably remember, depict the alleles for genes is by using letters. Large capital letters are used for dominance. Lowercase letters are used for recessives. So this would be here a homozygous dominant pea plant. That's the genotype. This would be a homozygous recessive pea plant. There's our genotype. Phenotypically, we get a large pea and a small pea. Let's say we cross these two, cross-pollinated these pea plants. They're going to have their gametes, little eggs and sperms in us. And they break apart, so you've got one copy, one allele for each gene going with your egg and your sperm. They get put back together, okay? So if a mummy and a daddy pea plant love each other very much, not quite, but so in the here, if we ended up with a gamete with a dominant and a gamete with a recessive, we would end up with a pea plant that would produce large peas. But it's not homozygous, it's heterozygous. We're going to have one dominant allele and one recessive allele. Let's say we cross two heterozygotes. Okay, your gametes are going to be dominant and recessive, break them in half, and over here, dominant and recessive. How do you find out what you get? You remember what's called a Punnett square. So you take the gametes from your female, put them out over there, your gametes from the male, put them out over there, and you just cross it through, sort of cross-multiply. So dominant, if a dominant egg meets up, or if an egg carrying a dominant allele meets up with a sperm carrying a dominant allele, for that gene, you've got two dominants, so homozygous dominant. If a recessive meets up with a dominant, you get a dominant and a recessive. We just tend to put the dominants first. The sort of standard notation is always write the dominant first, but it's not saying here the sperm is more important than the egg. It's just put dominant first. So we get a heterozygous. Over here, dominant from the egg, recessive from the sperm, another heterozygous, and if we happen to have an egg and a sperm, both have a recessive, then we get a homozygous recessive. Now, phenotypically, this is going to be big P, big P, big P, so three big, one small. Genotypically, though, it's a very different story, right? We've got one homozygous dominant, we've got two heterozygotes, and one homozygous recessive. That's what Mendel figured out. That was pretty big. Not that most people got it at the time, but big. All right. Now, a lot of work has been done after Mendel. It turns out not everything in genetics is going to follow Mendel's basic principles here. There's what we call, for example, linked genes. Okay, there's linkage. We get issues with, say, chromosomal crossing over during meiosis. It's called recombination, or sometimes called chromosomal mutation. There's differences between your autosomes and your sex chromosomes. Autosomes are not chromosomes that can transform into something else and fight the Decepticons. It sounds kind of like that, but. So you got your autosomes and your sex chromosomes. Then we get into the genetic mutations, actual mutations of the genes. Through all kinds of things can happen. You have single nucleotide polymorphisms. You can have trinucleotide repeats. You can have deletions. You can have insertions. It just goes on and on and on. The amazing thing, actually, with our genome is it's stunningly self-correcting. Will generally do a pretty damn good job of fixing itself when errors occur. And incidentally, whether or not you know it, you are all mutants. Unfortunately, that probably means that none of you have cool X-Men powers, which kind of sucks, but, you know, you're all mutants. You've on average got probably about 7 mutations in your genome. Do you have superpowers? Do you feel different? Done anything to prove it? Most mutations. Okay, here's the thing with mutations. The vast majority of mutations that exist in organisms that are actually functional are neutral. They do nothing. They really have no effect. Either because you're in an environment where it just doesn't really matter, or the mutation didn't actually affect protein production in any significant way. Remember, all a gene does is code for protein production, right? We say, you've got the brown-eyed allele of the eye color gene. It's another shortcut. You've got an allele for a particular gene that codes for proteins, and some of those proteins happen to be involved in making the iris of your eye. The proteins are probably doing a bunch of other things as well, but you don't really see those readily. You know, it could be involved in skin, elasticity. Oh, you've got the brown allele for skin elasticity. No. just shows up in eye color. I could do all kinds of things, right? Genes just code for protein production. But that takes a long time to say as well. So we talk about them doing this particular thing. So if you've got a mutation in a particular stretch of genome that's involved in a gene, you know what? Proteins are actually pretty complicated things. It may be that you actually just don't change the protein significantly in any way. It's like, oh, you've changed that little tiny molecular connection there. Meh, the protein still works entirely. Or because of our codon structure, how we only have, we could produce about far more amino acids than we actually make. We'll make 22 amino acids. We'll get just duplications. There's a whole number of codons that produce the same amino acid, which means, again, if you mutate from one to the other, it doesn't make any difference. So the vast majority of mutations that are out there in organisms that aren't, you know, dead due to the mutation, it's really just neutral. Matter of fact, the vast majority of mutations that are going to be detrimental will almost always just kill you before you were born. Detrimental mutations generally just lead to spontaneous abortion. It's unclear how often that happens in humans. If you look at the literature, estimations are that between 35 to 85% of pregnancies, or I'm sorry, I should say of conceptions, lead to a spontaneous miscarriage within the first trimester. Now, even if you go at the lower end of 35%, that's pretty high. If you take it up to 85%, that's still a lot of pregnancies that are spontaneously aborted. 85 is really high. But so, I mean, here's the deal. Here's the dealio. If this is happening in the first month post-conception, right? It goes, uh-oh, my period's late. Oh, no, I'm pregnant. A few days later, just has what seems like, oh, boy, that was a heavy period. Well, that could have been a spontaneous abortion. Yeah, maybe you were pregnant for a little brief period of time, but there was something catastrophically wrong. There was a really deleterious mutation in there, and the woman's body, the female's body, does this amazing job of assessing fetal fitness and goes, whoa, no, no, do not put 90,000 calories into this because it will not survive. Even if it does, it will not reproduce. So do not pass go. Do not collect. Just stop now. Start over. That's an amazing job of engineering on that. The female body is able to make that level of assessment. It's incredible. And it was probably evolutionarily very necessary. I mean, we live in this stunning environment of plenty. I know, you're undergrad students. I don't have plenty. Do you have a cell phone? Do you have a computer? Do you have clothes? Do you sort of eat at least twice a day? You have plenty. Compared to our entire evolutionary history, even the poorest university student is stunningly rich. Almost all Canadians are stunningly rich compared to our hunter-gatherer ancestors. We live in a land of multitude. We don't usually have to make harsh decisions. So abandoning a child to die seems really, really horrible to us. And it is. It is horrible. It's horrible for hunter-gatherers as well if they have to abandon a child. But if they don't, then other children die. Hard decisions. Evolutionarily, the fact that females' bodies can assess fetal fitness early and make that decision, that's massively adaptive. Those that don't stop early and restart lose a huge amount of energy. Their differential reproductive success over the lifespan is reduced. We'll come back to things like that a bit later. Anyways, my point here is that the vast majority of mutations are just probably going to kill an organism before it gets born. of those that make it through, they're neutral. And of the mutations that actually confer some real advantage to the individual, they are very, very few and far between. So old school discussion of evolution says evolution is driven by mutation. It's like, well, mutation is a part of it. You know, randomly something happens that gives an organism an advantage and it reproduces more, that advantage spreads. It's like, yeah, sure, that does happen, but that's not actually the predominant way of getting variation into the population. Okay? So mutation is only one source of genetic variability for a sexually reproducing species. If you're an asexually reproducing species, yeah, it's pretty important. If you're bacteria. But most of us aren't. Well, there's my cousin. But anyway, leaving that aside. So this is only one way that genetic variation gets in there. The vast majority of the variation between individuals actually comes from sexual reproduction. It's sometimes broadly called Mendelian variation, in the sense that we get the meiotic process that tears apart our chromosomes, packages them up in gametes, and then they get slapped back together when organisms reproduce. Okay. So that's actually the biggie, right? If you think about this, you're different from your parents, and you're different from your siblings, because of the random assortment, well, or at least let's say pseudo-random assortment, of the egg and the sperm that got together there. If it had been a slightly different little wiggly sperm that made it through to the egg, you'd be very, very different. Okay. The mutations that, you know, those on average 7 mutations you've got, that's not what primarily leads to the differences between you and your parents and you and your siblings. Most of it's coming down to sexual reproduction. Other ones, the recombination, you know, chromosomal mutations, chromosomal crossovers, those are very significant. And then finally, yes, there is mutations. There are the gene mutations in there, but these probably really account for the minority of the variation in the population. Here's another thing. Said that Mendel sort of looked at these things a very gene-by-gene process. But we know, in fact, that there are massive what are called polygenic effects. Not all genes are going to be either fully dominant or fully recessive. Okay, so there's incomplete dominance here. There's also what's called pleiotropy. Pleiotropy is where we have genes that do multiple things phenotypically. So, I mean, I don't actually know that the gene that we call the eye color gene is doing, you know, what it's doing protein-wise specifically. But, I mean, it's just producing proteins. Those proteins are probably used in all other kinds of the body, all other parts of the body as well for various things. So odds are you've got a gene doing multiple things. Lots of genes that do multiple things, especially when they interact with other genes. You got one gene that codes for a particular protein, another gene codes for another protein. Hey, those proteins actually fit together and produce an even larger protein. If one gene's turned off, you just get the second protein. If the other one's turned off, you get the first protein. If a third protein's turned, you know, being produced, something else happens. Okay, it's this wonderland of complexity inside your body. You know, for some people, this creeps them out. All that stuff's happening all the time in my cells. Yep. In billions and billions of cells. I feel itchy. Yeah. Genes will turn each other on or off. Genes are like light switches. Okay? So it turns on one light. Somebody, if you're in your house, you turn on one light. Okay, you can go turn another one off. Depending on the time of day, maybe you need both of them on. Maybe you need both of them off. You turn one on, maybe you don't need them. Well, let's not even get into dimmer switches, okay? That just complicates things enormously, right? But hey, there's your incomplete... Dimmer switches are like, you know, your incomplete dominance. I'm going to turn this one on half, which means I turn this one on full, but I can turn the other one off entirely. Right, okay, so that's genetics for you. Dr. Snyder's version of genetics, it's about lights in a house. Okay. So we can talk about modifier genes. These will influence the effect of another gene. We can have gene-gene interactions. And hey, let's not forget the environment. Depending upon the particular environmental parameters, that can turn genes on or off. Oh, so let's say, oh, here's a fun one, puberty. Well, actually, it's generally pretty hellacious for most people to go through, but, you know, when people say fun, they usually mean character building. Which generally means it sucks. But depending on the environment, depending on the amount of food energy that is available to you, puberty will be earlier or later. Environment influences gene activation. And then we get some seriously weird stuff. Okay, like genomic imprinting. So, typically, it doesn't matter whether it's the egg or the sperm that a particular allele comes in on. Generally, it's irrelevant. If you got a recessive, it doesn't matter if it comes from the egg or the sperm. If you got a dominant, it doesn't matter if it comes from the egg or the sperm. Okay. Less than 1% of the genes that we know about, or at least that we've discovered here, are what we call imprinted genes. With imprinted genes, the parental contributor actually does make a difference. So the gene dominant, it's not dominance and recessive just based on the gene itself. It's, if you want to use this terminology, it's dominant or recessive depending on whether it came from mom or dad. All right. So there's about 80 that have been discovered in humans so far. It's probably more. Initially discovered in plants, imprinted genes. Most of the mammalian imprinted genes that have been discovered are involved in embryonic and placental development. So, seems like some pretty basic stuff, but very, very important stuff. The best explanation for imprinted genes, or at least the most prevalent one, comes from Moore and Haig back in the early 90s, called the parental conflict hypothesis. Probably best way to explain this is with an example, the IGF-2 gene. So this is what we call a paternally expressed gene, which means the allelic form of it will only be active, in other words, the entire gene will only be active in terms of protein production if the active form comes in from the father, so it comes in on the sperm. What does IGF-2 do? Well, if IGF-2 gene activates, it leads to the production of what's called an insulin-like growth factor. What does that do? It makes for a bigger embryo. Makes for a bigger developing fetus. Okay. Let's think mammals here. There's a positive correlation between birth weight and health. A male, then, would like to have the largest possible embryo that he could. Whether he thinks about this or not. But from a biological perspective, males want to have big babies because big babies are more likely to survive childhood. Big babies are more likely to be healthier. Big babies are larger, likely to be larger and more successful and reproduce. And so that's a big win-win-win-win-win for the male. Now, if your baby's too big, if the embryo's too big, especially if you're things like humans, that could kill mom in childbirth because you just can't. Too big. Can't get out. Because we're bipedal. It's kind of messy. We'll talk about that some more later. So, but there's no real cost to dad, right? So, I mean, dad, the male impregnates the female. If the female dies, well, it doesn't kill dad. It doesn't kill the male. Yeah, I know that sucks, right? It's tough on the female, but there is. So from the male's point of view, from a strictly very hard, pragmatic, evolutionary perspective, getting a big embryo is a real benefit for the male. May not be. If the embryo is big but not fatal big, right? That's good for the female too because then she's going to have a particularly healthy offspring. So win-win. But if it's too big, then the male takes, if you will, a gamble on having a big baby, big offspring, big healthy offspring. But if it's too big, it crosses the threshold, female really loses out. Okay. So female would like to have a large embryo but not too large. Okay, big but not too big. So I go, wow, this really seems to suck. Once again, it's the paternal benefit here. It's patriarchy coming in, down at the genes. IGF-2 just benefits the guys once again. No. Females actually have evolved a counter to this. It's like genetic warfare. Okay? The females, there's another gene. It's a false receptor imprinted gene. And it only activates if it's contributed from the egg, and if there's an active IGF-2. So IGF-2, so if the false receptor imprinted gene is present, if it came in from the female, if it came in on the egg, and if there is an active IGF-2 gene, this turns on the false receptor imprint gene. What does the false receptor do? Well, basically it blocks the additional growth hormone. It blocks the additional insulin-like growth factor produced by the IGF-2 by essentially glomming onto it like a sponge and just sucking it up. At least that's my mental vision of what's going on with this. It's probably not really a good mental vision. I'm sure it works just like a sponge.
You don't really do a lot with subcellular protein production, do you? Nope. Not at all. But that's my mental, that's how I remember it. So, you know, sucking this up. Okay. So the IGF-2 gene. Okay. So imprinted genes. I mean, this is the thing. And this is the thing with evolutionary psychology. You need to be at least sort of peripherally familiar if you're going to work in evolutionary psych with what's going on in genetics. But you don't really need to get down to this kind of subcellular system with this. You don't really need to know all of this. Because evolutionary psychologists, they sort of accept and they say, yes, we've got this amazingly complex genetic system that produces variation in organisms, and the environment acts on the genes in some way to lead to more protein production or less protein production, and that leads to benefits or consequences. But that's what we're interested in. We're interested in this once it gets to the level of sort of the organism. Does it confer an advantage to the organism or not? So we have to know that all this genetic stuff is there. It's kind of in the same way. I mean, if you like listening to music on, you know, your iPhone or your iPod, you need to know that there's some sort of underlying electronic stuff that lets you do that. But you don't really need to know exactly how the microchip works to be able to enjoy listening to the music. There may be different apps that make listening to music better or worse. You know, are better at using the, you know, the bass or the treble or something. You can manipulate your little computer system to do better sound quality. I guess that's what we are at evolutionary psych. We're like at the level of the apps. Okay? We're like the apps and up. Okay, yes, there's an app for that. All right. We're done for the day. So have a good weekend, and we will see you next Tuesday. Wednesday. Monday! See you Monday. We didn't evolve in a time when there was days of the week. It was just day. I see you day. Good! Monday. Right.